welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never, folks. We're going to have to actually do something if we want to save our liberty. And we got Paul Venable back with us. Welcome back, Paul. And we were just cut off yesterday as you were diving into Article 6. And so we covered the nobility clause part. And then we went into the no state treaty part. And it was there where I think you were asking a question. But why don't you go ahead and start with no two or more states shall enter into a treaty with that.
Yeah, I'd like to do that again. Okay. No two or more states shall enter into any treaty, confederation, or alliance, whatever, between them without the consent of the United States and Congress assembled, specifying accurately the purposes for which the same is to be entered into and how long it shall continue. So these two clauses that starting at Article 6 seem to me that, first of all, this is carried over into the Constitution.
Correct.
And secondly, it is blatantly ignored. I've never lived in a state that doesn't have some kind of agreement with a foreign entity like sister cities or, you know, they're not even supposed to enter into a conference.
Right. Well, so many of the blue states today have entered and basically signed on to the Paris Accord, which is a global climate change treaty. And the fact that the states have actually done this without the consent of Congress, as a matter of fact, they did this and basically thumbed their nose because it happened during the Trump administration.
And that's interesting.
And the unconstitutional, or I should say the constitutionally illiterate President Trump didn't actually use his Department of Justice to pull in every single governor for treason.
Sure.
Because every governor that signed up with this, Jay Inslee, should have actually been dragged into a federal court and actually imprisoned and tried for treason. That's what should have happened. You have no constitutional authority to do that. And when you cross that boundary, at the minimum, you have done an insurgency against the Constitution.
So let's take this for a minute and say, we have, you know, we're going to have, you know, several weeks. You did a series on Mondays. It was something like, if I were president, or what would a president do?
Yes, a constitutional president. Yes.
What would a constitutional president do? So here, let's suppose we have a new president, and this president is going to enforce the Constitution. They're not going to dance around it. They're going to say, you know, my responsibility is to see that the laws of the union are enforced. And so he's going to start enforcing it. Okay. And one of these things is going to bring to a screeching halt all. He's not going to make anybody happy. Not in government.
Right.
All of these conferences, agreements, alliances, and treaties with any king, prince, or state or the United Nations. Right. And so I would see the first thing you should do is educate them and educate the states and say, this is going to stop happening. And then, you know, with a really short grace period, start using the power that the president has to enforce the Constitution. That's what I see. That's the way I imagine that this probably ought to happen, because this is, they're doing it as if everything's okay. I mean, it's complete ignorance, GR. It's not just Trump that's constitutionally illiterate. It's everyone that's constitutionally illiterate.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I get it.
There's something that needs. Yeah.
Well, so to be clear, you know, some of these players who have a legal degree, like Obama, what have you, they know they're violating the Constitution. Trump's a businessman. And so he looks at everything in his paradigm as business. And, you know, he doesn't understand. If you don't understand the rule of law, remember what Thomas Jefferson said? You know, ignorance
of law, yeah, there you go, is no excuse.
Because over time, and I'm just paraphrasing, over time, you can start pretending what the law is.
Correct.
And that's exactly what's happening. Well, you know, we're just going to ignore that part of the law, and we're going to just do this. And so many of these progressive governors, many of the progressive states, the legislatures, they're all doing things, and they have no authority to do them. You know, like the digital currency, all of these things that they're doing, everybody should be rounded up for and hauled in for treason. Right. This is a massive insurgency by government against the Constitution.
Yeah, there is an insurrection taking place.
Yes.
But it wasn't by the people on January the 6th.
Correct. That's what I've been saying ever since the beginning. I mean, as soon as January 6th went down and they started charging these people, the people that actually committed the crime, and they could easily get to that. They could find out who was involved in creating the lockdown, because that lockdown was a violation of the Constitution. You cannot keep the people from coming and basically petitioning government.
Right.
That okay. They cannot make any law that abridges that right.
Yeah.
And they did. So anyway. Yes.
So you want me to get to the – I'll go to the next one.
Yeah, now. So go ahead. Go. No state shall lay any impost.
No state shall lay any imposts or duties which may interfere with any stipulations or treaties entered into by the United States in Congress assembled with any king, prince, or state in pursuance of any treaties already proposed by Congress to the courts of France and Spain. Okay, so in other words, if there's a valid treaty, the states are not to interfere with it.
Yep.
It's simple as that, okay?
Right, and so, but actually, they're not to actually create any treaties either. I mean, so they're okay. Also kept from that, but keep going.
All right. No vessel of war shall be kept up in time of peace by any state, except such number only as shall be deemed necessary by the United States and Congress assembled for the defense of such state or its trade, nor shall any body of forces be kept up by any state in time of peace, except such number only as in the judgment of the United States and Congress assembled shall be deemed the requisite to garrison the forts necessary for the defense of such state. But every state shall always keep up a well-regulated and disciplined militia, sufficiently armed and accoutred, and shall provide and constantly have ready for use in public stores a due number of field pieces and tents, and a number, proper quantity of arms, ammunition, and camp equipage. That's interesting. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So they don't have, even then they didn't have a standing army, but they were required to keep arms and a sufficient number of men, I would say, for a force. They knew they needed enough defense to ward off something.
Right. But Congress, in the middle of that, Congress basically, it was their judgment to determine what they thought would be necessary.
Oh, right, correct.
In addition to the states need to do in addition to. But the Congress would basically say, well, we need to create fortage and garrisons and so forth. And so anyway. Mm-hmm. And that was carried over also. Many of these things that we're reading are either in Article 1 or Article 4, right?
Yeah, sure. Okay. That was carried over into the new Constitution.
Article 1, correct.
Okay. So Article 1.
So Article 1, Section 8, as far as the militia and the erection of forts and those things.
Right.
Yep.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. No state shall engage in any war without the consent of the United States in Congress assembled unless such state be actually invaded by enemies, or shall have received certain advice of a resolution being formed by some nation of Indians to invade such state, and the danger is so imminent as not to admit of a delay till the United States in Congress assembled can be consulted, nor shall any state grant commissions to any ships or vessels of war, nor letters of marque and reprisal, except it be after a declaration of war by the United States in Congress assembled, and then only against the kingdom or state and the subjects thereof under which war has been so declared, and under such regulations as shall be established by the United States in Congress assembled, unless such state shall be infested by pirates, in which case vessels of war may be fitted out for that occasion and kept so long as the danger shall continue, or until the United States and Congress assembled shall determine otherwise.
Okay, so basically this right here is a part of both, I think, Article 1 as well as Article 4.
Correct.
Okay. See, you see how, and this is what's really interesting. They took 13 articles and made 7.
Right.
Yeah.
So, let me ask you this off the wall question. Who can say they didn't just revise the Articles of Confederation? Because that's what it looks like.
Yeah, but what they did was they broke the magistrate, or the magistrate function of government, the single mm-hmm. body of Congress. That what they yes. did was they basically separated the roles and responsibilities of a magistrate and delegated those to 3 separate departments or branches. Mm-hmm. So they had an executive, they had the judiciary, and then more importantly, they had the all-powerful legislative.
Okay, but the role of the magistrate did not continue.
Correct. I mean, it was divided. In other words, having a single person with all power was basically done away with in America.
Okay. All right. When land, number 7, when land forces are raised by any state for the common defense, all officers of or under the rank of colonel shall be appointed by the legislature in each state respectively, by whom such forces shall be raised, or in such manner as such state shall direct, and all vacancies shall be filled up by the state which first made the appointment. Okay, so under the rank of colonel are appointed by the state.
Article 1, Section...
The legislature.
So this is Article 1, Section 8, where, you know, the naming of officers and all of that
right.
will be done, you know, for the militia.
This has to do with the militia also.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So let me go back to that magistrate question.
Okay.
Because as soon as you started reading, I go, you have to understand that the design was to make a system that empowered the people by their representation, that they had representation at every level of government, that they could control by, you know, basically delegating to suffrage, specific and limited suffrage for them. Mm-hmm. And so the thought of being a top-down government where somebody possessed, you know, the powers of a king or magistrate were basically completely wiped away in this design.
Okay. And even in this design, is that
right?
No.
In the U.S. Constitution, because they were maintaining most of this, that the states really possessed a lot of power, and the Continental Congress didn't possess enough. And so, what we had was states who all the states had different ways of functioning. They didn't have bicameral legislative bodies at this point in time. There were only a few states that did.
Okay.
And those states were broken into aristocracies. In other words, if you look at the British Parliament, it was representatives of the people on both sides. The aristocracy actually had 2 representatives.
What?
The aristocracy had 2 representatives. They were able to vote for their representative in the House of Lords in Parliament. And they appointed those people of affluence, appointed who would be their representative in the House of Lords was the aristocracy control. And then everybody voted for who was going to be the representative in the House of Commons. So, in other words, some people, you know, if you were richer, you were, had more money and more affluence, you had twice the say in the legislative body.
It's considering a monarchical form of government, they probably wanted that.
Yes.
We didn't.
And, well, but we didn't change that. You know, nine times out of ten, when you teach people to behave, and for a long time they behave a certain way, and then all of a sudden they want to break up and they go, it's, look at the party system. So the party system was maintained, you know, the two-party system, the Democrats and Republicans, was maintained for a very long time. It wasn't until the first breakup of 1971 with the Libertarian Party breaking away from the Republicans. But look at how the Libertarian Party formed. They formed in the same manner as the Republicans and the Democrats. In other words, they said, you know what, we're not going to, you know, reinvent the party from the bottom up. They just basically said, we're going to take that model and we're going to make our own little nuanced changes to it. And that's usually the same thing with governing. When, you know, when somebody walks in, it is very radical for a person to walk into a company and change its governance from, you know, from the bottom up.
Okay.
That's very radical. And most people really reject that type of change. It's almost like, you know, when a military commander comes in and basically takes the hierarchy away from the command and, you know, basically creates an open door policy, you know, and actually allows a democracy type of rule in the camp. I mean, if you really want to destroy leadership and cause, you know, this body, this governing body, military governing body, to go sideways, invoke democracy.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Anyway.
Okay.
Okay.
So I think we were number eight.
Yes. Go ahead.
Right?
Yep. Go ahead.
All charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States in Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all land within each state granted or surveyed for any person, as such land and the buildings and improvements thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States in Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint. So this, their tax collection depended on land, correct?
Yes.
All right.
So when they went to the apportionment of taxation under the Constitution, they had to determine how they wanted to apportion it. They could apportion by this, you know, acreage or by the person.
Okay.
And so what they ended up doing was they chose the person instead of the land because they felt that, you know, they tied apportionment of taxation and representation together.
Okay.
So when you look at, you know, how many representatives you have, that also accounts for how much taxation you'll have. Taxation without representation. So they tied the two together. Okay. And in this particular case, they, you know, moved away so that some areas, maybe some states, had a lot of land that they were carrying too much more of a burden compared to the other states. Just because you had the land, you know, didn't mean that, you know, you were making money off of that. I mean, a brand new state coming into the union, like if you look at some of the new states that joined the union, they were very sparse. They had hardly anybody there. I mean, not even 100,000 were, there were millions in these other states. And and maybe those states were even bigger. Virginia was a big state.
Right.
But if you're taxing by acre, you know, when Ohio came in, I mean, Ohio would have been paying a higher tax.
Right. By the way, Virginia was a big state, not the way we see it now. Virginia went out to the west quite a bit, didn't
it? Yeah, because Kentucky was a part of Virginia as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So the taxes for paying that proportion.
The taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled. So in other words, it was up to the state to determine how the taxes were going to be levied.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, so Article 9, and we got 4 minutes, so let's do it by paragraph and just keep track of the time. So go ahead.
The United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive power of determining on peace and war, except in the cases mentioned in the sixth article, of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering into treaties and alliances, provided that no treaty of commerce shall be made whereby the legislative power of the respective states shall be restrained from imposing such imposts and duties on foreigners as their own people are subjected to, or from prohibiting the exportation or importation of any species of goods or commodities, whatever, of establishing rules for deciding in all cases what captures on land or water shall be legal, and in what manner prizes taken by land or naval forces in the service of the United States shall be divided or appropriated, of granting letters of marque and reprisal in times of peace, appointing courts for the trial of piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and establishing courts for receiving and determining, finally, appeals in all cases of captures, provided that no member of Congress shall be appointed a judge of any of the said courts.
Okay, so what we're seeing here is there's a lot of language that actually got condensed when they moved this into the Constitution in Article 1 and actually part of Article 4. And so what I'll do is let's just kind of let me do this next one here. I'll kind of, you know, keep an eye on the time here. The United States and Congress assembled shall also be the last resort on appeal in all disputes and differences now subsisting or hereafter may arise between two or more states concerning boundary, jurisdiction. So what we're reading right here, and this is why I wanted to do this, this is where they're giving the jurisdiction, the judiciary jurisdiction. They're not creating a judiciary. They're just saying we have jurisdiction over these things in a court. They didn't create a court. They just said we have the jurisdiction over these things. That they, in the last resort, on all appeals and all disputes, differences now subsisting or that hereafter may arise between two or more states concerning boundary, jurisdiction, or any other causes, whatever, which authority shall always be exercised in the manner following. And so they're going to get into this manner following, and I don't want to start diving into that. But bottom line, at this point, they're just saying that they're kind of like the arbiters between the states that have, you know, this limited jurisdiction. Now, one of the points is that they talk about all of these different things that the court has, and they use a lot of language here. But bottom line, when they went into the U.S. Constitution, they basically capped and limited the court's jurisdiction over only those things arising under the Constitution. Now, they did talk about disputes between states, and they also included disputes between a person of another state with, you know, a person in a different state. And remember, the 11th Amendment, they came back and said, we see a problem with this. And so they actually, with the 11th Amendment, wiped that jurisdiction out. So it really moved the federal government and the court back into basically, you know, being, you know, the cop, or, you know, making sure that states don't pit against each other and being that final arbiter. They weren't to pick favorites. They were not to pick favorites. And actually, we'll get into that in the ratification debates. We've covered this as well in the ratification debates. But going into break, we will be right back after this promo. But again, what we're covering here is the jurisdiction, the, you know, the influence that the limited confederation, or I should say Continental Congress, had over the states. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so the reason I just wanted to kind of, you know, start this off is kind of really setting the stage so everybody can see where, you know, where this Continental Congress was really, as far as the judiciary goes, it had very limited power. As a matter of fact, going into the break, I really laid it out, and just welcome back, Paul, by the way, just in case you might be muted.
Thank you.
Okay. So the legislative authority, you know, was clearly vested in Congress, and the judicial, the determination of, you know, what to do was actually set into a very fixed judiciary as well. They did not have a judiciary. And we're going to dive into this. And so I'll go ahead and let you pick it up from whenever the legislative or executive authority. So go ahead and pick it up from right there. Because
yes.
All right.
Okay. Whenever the legislative or executive authority or lawful agent of any state in controversy with another shall present a petition to Congress stating the matter in question and praying for a hearing, notice thereof shall be given by order of Congress to the legislative or executive authority of the other state in controversy in a day assigned for the appearance of the parties by their lawful agents, who shall then be directed to appoint by joint consent commissioners or judges to constitute a court for hearing and determining the matter in question. But if they cannot agree, Congress shall name three persons out of each of the United States, and from the list of such persons, each party shall alternately strike out one, the petitioners beginning, until the number shall be reduced to 13, and from that number not less than 7, nor more than 9 names, as Congress shall direct, shall in the presence of Congress be drawn out by lot, and the persons whose names shall be so drawn, or any 5 of them, shall be commissioners or judges to hear and finally determine the controversy. So always as a major part of the judges who shall hear the cause shall agree in the determination, and if either party shall neglect to attend at the day appointed without showing reasons which Congress shall judge sufficient, or being present shall refuse to strike, the Congress shall proceed to nominate 3 persons out of each state, and the Secretary of Congress shall strike in behalf of such party absent or refusing, and the judgment and sentence of the court to be appointed in the manner before prescribed shall be final and conclusive. And if any of the parties shall refuse to submit to the authority of such court, or to appear or defend their claim or cause, the court shall nevertheless proceed to pronounce sentence or judgment, which shall in like manner be final and decisive. The judgment or sentence and other proceedings being in either case transmitted to Congress and lodged among the acts of Congress, for the security of the parties concerned, provided that every commissioner, before he sits in judgment, shall take an oath to be administered by one of the judges of the Supreme or Superior Court of the state where the cause shall be tried, well and truly to hear and determine the matter in question according to the best of his judgment, without favor, affection, or hope of reward, provided also that no state shall be deprived of territory for the benefit of the United States. That is a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, and you can see that Congress is just kind of, you know, overseeing the process, and Congress is, you know, bringing forth a jury of a court, but, I mean, they are not really trying the case. In other words, they become the impartial third party that goes out and tries to get the most impartial case, or I should say the most impartial court possible. And you can see why the states wanted to keep, because, you know, what threat is this?
Right.
You know, so I could see why the states really did not. And this goes back to why they disputed, you know, the judiciary, this permanent judiciary underneath the federal government.
Okay.
That this didn't exist, or that didn't exist in this at all, that Congress basically just, you know, they had this interest of seeking justice. But
okay.
But they didn't have the power of delivering and or rendering. And, I mean, it was just like, it's good that they were trying to work out disputes, but I don't think that there was ever, you know, a landmark case where a state, you know, after some type of dispute that, you know, ever came to any resolution because there was no force.
So, and these were, it sounds to me like these were disputes between states. I mean, the states had their own courts.
Uh-huh. Yes, they did.
Okay.
Yes.
And so,
that became problematic because if it's your court, then when we look at the federal government, when the states are suing the federal government, how does, 9 times out of 10, what is the verdict? Almost 100% of the time, the court rules in favor of protecting the federal government.
Sure.
And so what they were trying to do here was they wanted to make sure that that could never happen, but then the true justice could never be served because, you know, even if you went into court and even though, you know, they're going to create this ruling, there was no force to force the big state, if it had the power to do so, it could say, well, we're just going to ignore that ruling.
Mm. Okay, so there is no enforcement
mechanism. There you go.
Okay.
And eventually, you know, what would have eventually happened is that the bigger states would have basically just, you know, kind of ignored the you know, like with Virginia being next to Delaware and Maryland, mm-hmm. they would have just ignored each other. And then, you know, the Carolinas and Virginia, they would have just been at odds or what have you. Either they had to learn to get along or
right.
they would just, you know, sever their relationship. And if they did that, see, everybody understood that if Virginia actually, you know, said, we're not going to go along with this, because you already pointed out that Virginia stretched into Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was the Mason County line, if you want to call it that, you know, or it was this barrier. If all of a sudden they said, we're not playing with you Union folks, and if the Carolinas and Georgia was a part of the Union, they would be a big obstruction. You'd have to, the only way you could get to the North is by ship.
Right.
I mean, you know, look how far you'd have to go to the West to go around Virginia. You'd have to go all the way out to the Mississippi.
Right. Right.
That wouldn't have been tenable. And
so Virginia was a linchpin.
Virginia, New York was another major linchpin. Both of these were very big states that had a lot of power. They had a lot of population. They had, you know, these ports. Yeah, they were, this is one of the reasons why it was brought up by the, you know, Delaware, the delegates from Delaware, where they just came right out and said during the Constitutional Convention why they didn't want to allow the, you know, apportionment by, you know, strictly creating a federal government by population, because they recognized that their populations were so small that these, they would be swallowed up. And they said, we don't trust you big states.
Right.
And there's a reason why we created a state and didn't become a part of Virginia, because we didn't like what you were doing. You were just, you know, a bunch of money greedy people. And we, you know, it was about religious persecution for us or whatever their cause was. Right. Mm-hmm. So they had, most people don't realize how divided they really were over what they thought was important at the time.
Well, not only how divided they really were, but how they actually came together eventually, regardless of their division, put together the Constitution.
That's, to me, that's the miracle. This is why I keep harping on how important it is to put aside yourself, your differences, and your self-interest. See, these states had self-interest. These states had differences, and they put them aside, because they understood that they were strong, they were all much stronger together if they could figure out how to get along. Now, if you look at what divided them back then, it's, you know, it's just, it, today it's comical. We wouldn't allow those things, slavery and those types of things. We have literally turned that corner, and it's well behind us, if you know what I mean. But today we're equally divided, and we are driven by our own self-interests.
Well, I think we're also being divided by...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're right. Absolutely.
You know, by powers that rival the power of Britain at the time.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Money powers. And so where are we now?
All next controversies concerning the private right of soil.
Okay. All controversies...
Now, hold on here. Now, hold on here. This is about mineral rights.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
All controversies concerning the private right of soil claimed under different grants of two or more states whose jurisdiction is they may respect such lands, and the states which passed such grants are adjusted, the said grants or either of them being at the same time claimed to have originated antecedent to such settlement of jurisdiction, shall on the petition of either party to the Congress of the United States be finally determined as near as may be the same in the same manner as is before prescribed or for deciding disputes respecting territorial jurisdiction between different states.
Now, back in those days, they didn't have a lot of mining, right? As a matter of fact, you know, salt mines were one of those few things that they started, you know, they started realizing that America had some, you know, a lot of resources under the soil, but they didn't necessarily have what they called soil rights, was, you know, the entire soil. And later on, they started delineating mineral rights. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't until 1819 when the federal government, you know, made this assertion, because they recognized salt was a commodity that was very precious. They didn't want to have to buy salt from Britain or any other, you know, external source. And they found these salt mines as they started moving to the West. And in Indiana, there were several salt mines that they found. And in Indiana, in 1819, when it became a state, they basically, they overreached, they broke the Constitution, they violated the Constitution by saying, you know, we don't want, telling them that they didn't want them to sell those salt mines, that they were considered a national resource, and that they would, you know, if the state felt necessary, they could lease them for periods of time, but could never sell them.
So in other words, the feds were telling Indiana what to do with their property.
With their mineral and their mineral rights, correct. This is the first time that so what I'm trying to lay out is at this point in time, there was no enumerated power, because we hear today that you have no mineral rights when you buy your property. Well, that was never delegated. We the people never gave the federal government the ability to take and control mineral rights. They just assumed it. they just started assuming it as a national interest. And the states just kind of went along with it. It's, if you look up mineral rights, you know, or mining and those types of things in your state constitution, it's not there. At least the constitutions that I've looked at, it's not there. The federal government made this broad assertion that they control all mineral rights.
When did they do that?
Well, I I'm telling you, in 1819, it was over salt.
I see. So in other words, but see, this isn't delegated or enumerated. So they suggested that. They made that assertion.
And over time, they became more aggressive in saying, you can't do this, you can't do this. And they started assuming this is why today all mineral deposits are controlled really by the federal government.
But they don't have that authority. So in other words, Indiana didn't push back and say, you know, that's a nice thing for you to say, but you're wrong, right?
Correct.
They just didn't do that.
Correct. As a matter of fact, it was in Indiana's best interest to become a state. They wanted to become a state because they wanted right. representation. And it was in right. it was in the union's best interest that Indiana joined, because then they become a contributor in taxation.
So what you just shared with me was something I really didn't know. What you're saying is that the United States has claimed by default, but without authority, the mineral rights of the states.
That is correct. Because, you know, who, if you actually go, you know, everybody, you know, these people are kind of oblivious. They honestly believe that, well, we don't have mineral rights.
I never believed that. I believed if I bought property that I had the mineral rights.
Oh, no. If you tried to create a mine. So there are mining operations that are allowed on state and on private property as long as you're not digging. You know,
well,
like you can go out to
if you're
panning.
Digging.
Okay, so panning, you can pan for gold. But if go into digging and so forth, 9 times out of 10, there may be some shared, you know, mineral rights deposits and so forth. But bottom line, I've yet to see any state where they've actually had that enumeration. I think that what ended up happening in the early 1800s, and as a matter of fact. So we're working on a petition that actually pulls all this in, that, you know, highlights how the federal government started creating these mining and control acts. And it was in the early 1800s when they started going down this path of doing that and controlling these things. These were all assumptions or usurpations. So
I'm kind of surprised. So picture this. Okay. I know people who have, you know, lived in Texas and struck oil, and so that's theirs. You're saying no. It's not theirs.
So right now, the federal government uses the EPA. I said, there was a shared. There was a shared responsibility. But if you really look at what the federal government was doing, when they found gold mines, like in Utah, Wyoming, and so forth, what did they do? They seized that property as national reserves. How much property has the federal government taken out of our mineral rich West?
Well, I'll tell you, 85% in Nevada. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, and so when we look at the states. The states, basically, as the federal government came along, they, you know, kind of gave a stipend and helped the states. They all seized control together unconstitutionally. If you own that land, you own that land. And so the state can come in and regulate you and say, oh, you can't conduct, you know, this is a residence, this is a property for this, or however they zone you. And they've created these ways of regulating you that when you start tapping into, you know, the ground itself, you know, and pulling things out of the ground, whether it be gold, oil, it doesn't matter. You know, they will come in and regulate or tell you, you can't conduct that type of business there. Doesn't matter how rich you are.
Wow. Isn't that interesting?
Right. And it's only gotten worse over time. And, you know, so this actually benefited who? It benefited the oil companies as the Standard Oil formed. And as, you know, oil was being found throughout the United States, you know, people were creating their own little wells and making some money. And they mm-hmm. just didn't want that because that created competition.
I want to say, tell me you're kidding, but I know you're not.
No, these people who created these monopolies or these large businesses started using, this is what I was talking about yesterday when we talked about the industrial age and how they started getting government to create rules and regulations to protect them from competition.
Right.
And so, go ahead.
And they had money. And yes. Because they had money, then they could influence people, politicians, correct?
That is correct. Yep. Yeah, so, you know, even though there have been businesses that have been good actors, there have been more businesses that have been bad actors than, you know, than we want to even think about. And as a matter of fact, there's no doubt in my mind, government has probably broached a lot of these deals to say, you know, if you let us do this, we can do this and start working together.
Probably.
Yeah. So anyway, go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. Am I the United States and Congress the sole and exclusive right and power of regulating the alloy and value of coins struck by their own authority or by that of the respective states, fixing the standards of weights and measures throughout the United States, regulating the trade and managing all affairs with the Indians not members of any of the states, provided that the legislative right of any state within its own limits not infringed or violated, establishing or regulating post offices from one state to another throughout all the United States, and exacting both postage on the papers passing through the same as may be requisite to defray the expenses of the said office, appointing all officers of the land forces in the service of the United States, excepting regimental officers, appointing all the officers of the naval forces and commissioning all officers, whatever, in the service of the United States, making rules for the government and regulation of the said land and naval forces and directing their operations. Real quick, I have a question. What is a regimental officer? I was not in the service, so can you share that with
me? So regimental is a army officer. They have these ranks of regiments and so forth. And so,
I mean, over a certain size, is that what this thing?
Yes, yes, yes. In other words, a commander over a certain size of, you know, troops. Okay, so you have divisions, you have regiments, you have battalions, you have companies, you know, they go down, down, down. So when you get to a certain point where a commander over a certain amount of people, then there's, you know, they wanted to basically have that control over those officers for those appointments. In other words, they considered a regimental officer an officer that would be basically commanding, you know, forces of two states or, you know, militias of two states or what have you. So they wanted to say, okay, that's going beyond the state itself.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. That's what I thought, but that helps what you said. Okay, I'm ready for the next one. Is the United States and Congress assembled?
Okay.
Shall have authority to appoint a committee to sit in the recess of Congress to be denominated a committee of the states and to consist of one delegate from each state and to appoint such other committees and civil officers as may be necessary for managing the general affairs of the United States under their direction, to appoint one of their members to preside, providing that no person be allowed to serve in the office of president more than 1 year in any term of 3 years, to ascertain the necessary sums of money to be raised for the service of the United States, and to appropriate and apply the same for defraying the public expenses, to borrow money or emit bills on the credit of the United States, transmitting every half year to the respective states an account of the sums of money so borrowed or admitted to build and equip a navy, to agree upon the number of land forces, and to make requisitions from each state for its quota.
Uh-huh.
In proportion to the number of white inhabitants of in such state, with which requisition shall be binding, and thereupon the legislature of each state shall appoint the regimental officers, raise the men and clothe, C-L-O-A-T-H. What is that? Raise the men and clothe.
In other words, give them uniforms.
Oh, clothe.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Arm and equip them in a solid-like manner at the expense of the United States, and the officers and men so clothed, armed, and equipped shall march to the place appointed and within the time agreed on by the United States and Congress assembled.
Okay, let's stop right there.
Yeah, okay.
And so what I'm going to do is highlight that whole part of that paragraph. And so clothed, okay. You know, clothed, well, same yeah. thing. Okay, so archaic speech. So one of the things that they talked about here is mm-hmm. that if Congress is going to have a recess,
right.
they will appoint a committee and basically to sit in their stead. In other words, there will always be somebody in government, even if the Continental Congress, you know, is not in session. So in other words, they would create a small a committee, and they basically break it down that there'll be a president that will, you know, reign on the committee for more than a year out of the term of 3 years. Anyway, so they go into the administration of what to do when they're not in business. And then they also started talking about building and equipping a navy. And they started talking about, you know, how to, you know, maintain the militia and the responsibility of Continental Congress of the United States in arming and equipping and training the militia.
Right.
So, in other words, everything we're kind of reading here was really summarized in Article 1, Section 8 regarding the militia part. But this committee was something different.
It was something different.
Because they didn't have, in other words, when they created the federal government, they created a permanent federal government that mm-hmm. then would create these, the executive, which would have an executive department where there'd be the Department of Treasury. And so in other words, certain functions would continue to, you know, always operate, even if Congress wasn't in session.
Sure.
But back then, they didn't have executive nor an executive branch or judiciary. So they had to have something there that they could right. still serve the union.
Essentially, Congress was everything.
Yes, it was. It was a doctrine of magistrate where they possessed all this power, even though they were not a federal or a federation. They were a general government, where there were just limited and defined powers, which bottom line, when we look at the U.S. Constitution, it didn't change that. It only created a permanent federal government instead of, you know, having this power to appoint a committee to make sure that this general government was available to serve the union. So with that, we're done for the day. And thank you for your time, Paul. Thank you for helping out. Folks, as you can tell, the Articles of Confederation, you know, were very similar to the U.S. Constitution. There were just some real new paradigm shifts that the framers, through inspiration, in creating the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way, we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.